In continuing our theme of the sacred, Dick Dahl has graciously agreed to speak to us today, and he provided an intro to help me introduce him. I would probably get distracted by just remarking on how kind he is. I'll never forget, he asked me something. He emailed me in my role as member of the Sunday Service Committee, and luckily I had exactly what he wanted, so I was able to respond right away, and he emailed back and said, "Thank you, Laura, you win first prize," and I thought, oh. There's something about Dick saying that that's like better than your kindergarten teacher, you know? So I'm glad he wrote this so that I wouldn't get all sentimental. Dick has been a member of this fellowship for about 5 years. He's the father of 4 adult children and has lived in Winona for about 30 years. He first came here to work at what was then St. Mary's in an administrative position and then taught for 8 years in the history department at Winona State. And during those years, simultaneously began what turned into an incredible life as a Renaissance man, 24 years as an alcohol and drug counselor at a private clinic, and being an assistant pastor at the All Our One Roman Catholic Parish, which meets at the Lutheran Student Center. He also is active in the Learning Club, the Wellspring Singers, and the Sons of Norway. And he stopped working 2 years ago, which I don't actually believe at all, and he now reads a lot. So welcome, Dick.
For the third time, good morning. Actually, I looked it up, and I've actually been taking part in this fellowship for 7 years and been a member for 6. I want to thank Laura and Pippa for choosing the music. They got some idea what I was going to talk about, so they picked out music that seemed to fit with this, and I appreciate that. Our fourth principle is, as you know, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, which I have understood to be from any and every source available to us. In the spirit of that principle, I want to share with you what the sacred means to me. I begin with a quote from Marcel Proust: "The voyage of discovery is not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes." When I was 13, shortly after I became a Roman Catholic, I made a further decision to transfer to St. George High School in Evanston across Chicago's northern border, where each class began with the invitation, "Let us remember we are in the holy presence of God." An invitation, as it were, to have new eyes. 100 years before I was born, the Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard wrote, "There are 2 ways to be mistaken, to be fooled. One is to believe what isn't true. The other is to refuse to believe what is true." Religion and reason have often been viewed as being at odds with each other. I view them as complementary, each a vital way of understanding and experiencing reality, with a capital R, of having the new eyes that Proust spoke of. We are coming to understand that the human mind opens us to reality in a variety of ways, reason being one, but only one of those ways. Even Einstein said he was led to his insights more through intuition than by reason alone. Last year, in an exhibit at the Minnesota Marine Art Museum, Leo Smith III posted the following statement next to his artwork: "An epiphany is an emotional, visual experience felt in the heart, viewed in the eyes. It is not some intellectual concept, it is emotional. An epiphany is a sense of wonder, to stand bereft of reason before a marvel." 3,000 years ago, a man named David, who became king of Israel, expressed his sense of overwhelming wonder by exclaiming, "Lord, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them." Human beings have sought and been aware of the sacred in many ways, in many places, over vast periods of time. The Hopi Indians, a subgroup of the Pueblos in southwestern North America, had the following chant, which I invite you to sing after me. It's little phrases. O Ichi Chayo, O Ichi Chayo, O Weayo, O Weayo, where we walk is holy. Sacred is the ground.
Sacred is the ground.
Forest, mountain, river.
Forest, mountain, river.
Listen to the sound.
Listen to the sound.
In his book, The Snow Leopard, Peter Matheson writes, "As in the religions of the great religions of the East, the Native American makes small distinction between religious activities and the acts of everyday life. The religious ceremony is life itself." Furthermore, he goes on, "like the Atman of the Veda, like the Buddhist mind, Tao, the great spirit of the American Indian is everywhere and in all things. By manifesting the sacred, any object becomes something else, yet it continues to remain itself. In India or Nepal, Himalaya, to greet another person with namaste means to bow to the God within them." About 3,000 years ago, the first words of what were even then ancient traditions began to be put into writing in the first book of what would become a library of books, or Biblia, or Bible. Those first words were, "In the beginning." Without the scientific evidence as to when our universe began with the Big Bang, the book of Genesis describes the beginning of a creative process that we now know is ongoing. Several hundred years later, another book was added to that library that echoed the former, but with much fuller meaning. Its first words were also "in the beginning," and then added was "the Word." It goes on. "The Word was with God, the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." What a mind-blowing vision, what an epiphany, that all matter, from the inner quantum universe of electrons, gluons, and leptons, to the macro universe billions of light years across, is divinized, penetrated, sustained by a reality that many relate to as loving and personal. Now, to put what we believe and think we know in perspective, I want to refer to the writing of Lisa Randall, a theoretical physicist at Harvard and a leading expert on particle physics and cosmology. In 2011, she wrote a challenging but wonderful book entitled Knocking on Heaven's Door, in which she noted the following. Less than 100 years ago, no one knew the universe was expanding. Astronomer Harold Shapley then attempted to measure the size of the Milky Way, which he thought to be 300,000 light years across. In 1920, he argued that the Milky Way encompassed the entire universe. Just a few years later, Edwin Hubble realized that some of what Shapley had thought were clouds in the Milky Way were in fact galaxies millions of light years away. Science now determines that the entire visible universe is 100 billion light years across, a million times the size of our galaxy. Now, what this means to me is that the human mind has been able, through laborious cooperation with others over centuries, to discover and correct much that is inaccurate, much that people in science and religion mistakenly thought was true, from viewing the Earth as the center of the universe to Shapley's conviction in 1920 that the universe consisted solely of the Milky Way galaxy. We don't disparage earlier scientific understanding by later insights that corrected mistaken notions. We can marvel at the way people in the distant past tried to make sense of their lives in this world, even though we now recognize that they were incorrect in some of what they thought and said. And the time in which we live also has its limitations. Some people today reject notions of natural and supernatural because they consider such distinctions to be medieval and based on a false understanding of reality. Yet scientists like Lisa Randall have come up with theories of different dimensions of reality that they have no difficulty seriously considering. She notes, "It is easy for us to think we know all there is to know." Peter Morales, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, wrote recently, "Love is our longing for connection. A search for connection is at the heart of all spiritual traditions and practices." Faith is not the same as believing things to be true or false, but rather a way of opening up our minds and spirits to the mystery of reality that infuses our lives and our universe. Franciscan priest Father Richard Rohr asks, "Why has anyone thought people must believe in God in order to experience God?" I don't think Lisa Randall believes in God, but she writes, "We have to be absorbed enough to continue working through what does and does not make sense. This is the sincere openness that I think is the essence of the spiritual life." Eckhart Tolle, author of The Power of Now, never uses the word God. He says the word is a closed concept and therefore cannot convey or describe the reality beyond limits. In a similar view, 900 years ago, Bonaventure, a follower of Francis of Assisi, wrote, "God is a point, present everywhere, with no circumference." In other words, imminent, as close to us as the air we breathe and the blood in our veins, yet also transcendent beyond our comprehension. This reflects how I understand and relate to the mystery of the sacred. Finally, in our efforts to avoid believing what is not true, may we avoid refusing to believe what is true. I'm reminded of the book The White Tiger, a book I read a few years ago by an Indian author, Aravind Adiga, who ended it with the statement, "You were looking for the key for years, but the door was always open." Well, that's what I have to say. Actually, the title wasn't what was printed in the newsletter or what Laura said. The title was "The Sacred Dimension of Reality." I chose my own title anyway. I guess we have plenty of time. I don't know if anyone has any comments, not comments, but your own thoughts. I, to be honest with you, I wrote this to a great extent with Bob Youngerman in mind. Bob is a friend of mine. He hates the word God. We were singing some hymn. And, do we have to put God? And it's been a real struggle. because I know people have many different views of what's real, and understandably are turned off, horribly turned off, by ways in which religion and religions have distorted what they're about and what religion is. We see this with the Muslim extremists, we've seen it with crusaders, we've seen it with many ways of trying to force a way of thinking on people, subjecting them often to horrific pain and torture over the years. Narrow-mindedness, and what really drew me was to this fellowship was that fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, which I do find in many religious expressions, and for example in the inclusive All Are One community with Pastor Kathy Redig meets at the Lutheran Student Center. But anyway, any comments you have, or will we end early? Yes, Jim.
I really appreciate this, Dick, and I appreciate you being really vulnerable and sharing, you know, because I know, like you say, I think there's a modern attitude, you know, that would create a kind of reverse fundamentalism, that we can't talk about God anymore, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of the area of my research and something of my talk last week is involved with this. And so I would say one of the things that I've been really intrigued by is that my sort of guru, Bruno Latour, has published a book on this issue. It's called The Torments of Religious Speech. And one of the things he talks about is that religion, now that science is so good at explaining origins, you know, and things like that, that religion is freer in a lot of ways to do what it always was best at, and that is not belief, but conversion. And what he means by conversion is the conversion of the heart. You know, that when we're here, the point is not that we can all get our origin story straight or figure out whether the universe is expanding or not, but that we can love each other. We can be converted from the selfish bastards that we are to people that really care about each other. You know, that's that coming together, that conversion of the heart to create this sacred community where, you know, it's very hard. It's hard to love sometimes. And you need all the inspiration you can get. And that idea that he says, it's an interesting moment where he says, you know, like when a lover says to his beloved, when the beloved says to the lover, "Do you love me?" The recipient of that request doesn't say, "I already told you I love you. You know, I told you that many, many times. Don't you believe me?" So it's not a matter of belief. At that moment, when that person says, "Do you love me?" That's when the love is going to happen, when you turn and say, "Yes, I do." In other words, we come together to say not we believe in something, but we are something. We're going to be something. And so I think that so often, much of the torturous, you know, the history of religion where things go bad is like, you can talk about the Inquisition. It's when people are forcing you to believe something, not trying to get you to be something. You know, to get you to be something would be a different question. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does to me. Anyone else? Yes, Steve?
There's this quote, I don't remember exactly, but I thought of it during Jim's talk earlier this year and then again this year. It's by Rilke in the Notebooks of the Multilodis Brigga, and he makes a comment about how could we even imagine that we all mean the same thing by the word God? Mm-hmm. And he has this nice image. If you give two boys a pocket knife, two identical pocket knives, a week later those knives will be completely different because of the way they've used them. Mm-hmm. And I think the word God, you know, I use it and it's helpful to me, but what really matters is, and for other people it's an obstacle, what our conception of the sacred, whatever you want to call it, I think what matters is how do we use it and how do we find it useful? What you know, set of beliefs and practices, or image, I don't even want to use the word beliefs, it's more images, I think. It's that, like you, the other quote, it's at a more emotional intuitive level. It's not even really at a rational level, but what? How do your images help you seek out the sacred and then practice it by loving other people? That's where I think a lot of mainstream religions have focused on the wrong things.
You know, and the atmosphere created by surroundings can lead to that, but then, you know, a cathedral or, I know Dwayne Bagley said, you know, we meet in a place with fluorescent bulbs. This doesn't lend itself to a sense of that. But then the trouble is, my sense of reality, God, whatever term you want to use, isn't confined to a place. It is among the fluorescent lights and the slums and the landfill and, you know, wherever else. You know, it's, and so I think it's, although those places or music or, you know, many different things, oops, can open us to a sense of what's real in which we live, but it's not confined to that. Anyway, any other thoughts people want to share? Yes, Laura?
This is making me think of a story from last year. Usually I teach ninth grade, and part of that curriculum is the Odyssey. And to prepare my students for that, we do a project together about the Greek gods and goddesses. And usually my students just get all involved in, you know, sisters and brothers marrying each other and who gets the thunderbolt and why. And they got all involved in that. But one student approached it in a way I've never seen any ninth grader approach it before. She looked at me with this look of utter disgust. And she said, "Were the Greeks high all the time or were they just stupid?" And I was kind of nonplussed, and I said, "Can you say a little more about what you're doing?" And she said, "Well, who would believe all this stuff?" And I was like, "Okay, calm down, you know." And I said, "Well, just try to imagine that you've never learned any science, and that you just saw a volcano erupt, and you don't know why. Like, what would you say?" And she said, "Oh." And like then we were able to move forward, right? But I think one of my missions and one of the difficulties of modern thinking, because as you say, we have science, is that, you know, to put yourself into that vulnerable place of thinking, there are mysteries around, and they might stay mysteries, or I might have to put myself in that scary place of imagining all the possible answers. That's not something everybody's really good at or comfortable doing. So your talk made me think about, you know, the quest that I'm on with people in that.
The people have always been on, I think. You know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I think it's interesting to think about, you know, how many religions have origin stories, and to think about the possibility. Well, you know, now that we have science, will some of those origin stories go away as being so central to those religions? And would that make things better? would that make, you know, people be able to connect to each other more? But I just, you know, what Jim said about the purpose of religion being conversion of the heart, yes, I wish it was, but so often I feel like the purpose of religion is, it deals with something that's kind of connected to our origin, but it's just as fundamental as that. It's that people are afraid. People are afraid. They don't know who they are and where they came from, and that's where the origin stories come from. But they don't know where they're going and who they can be with and who they can trust. So we create this whole in-group, out-group thing. And that's another unfortunate thing that religions are so very good at. And so it's like, it isn't just so much, do you believe the same thing I do, but you know, are you my group and they are the other, you know? And so I just wonder if origin stories start to disappear, maybe some of that could start to disappear too, because I do think they are interconnected, but that sense of creating the other in order to make yourself feel safer is so central to so many religions.
Probably central to human nature that we
out with it feeds on
kinship, tribes, you know.
Yeah.
And, although there's, I think, a growing awareness Well, first of all, I mean, our group, or whatever religious or typical kind of group you think of, tends to draw people who have similar values and think a lot, even though we have our differences. This may involve a little broader range, although it's still kind of a intellectual, white, primarily, you know, kind of upper class, at least in terms of culture. I don't know, maybe that's a prejudiced way of looking at it, but and so to be truly inclusive, actually what I was going to is, I've heard this from several people, and I know how extremely hard it is for me. The best outcomes come when people have different views, and yet they're able to talk together in some respectful way and come up with some kind of a middle ground. Maybe it's, I don't know, not compromise, but some kind of a deeper insight that those who hold strongly other views have something that they're holding on to. There's something, even though the way in which it's expressed may be abominable to us, there's something, and if we could somehow connect with that. But it's very hard for me to talk with people who have different views than mine. That's why Bob and I, even though we're good friends, I really struggle with his aggressive atheism. But anyway, maybe that's neither here nor there. But I think that's the real challenge. And as long as we stay in our separate groups, we don't make much progress. Anyone else? How are we doing time-wise? Yes, Fred.
Well, I've been a Baptist, and I've been a non-Baptist, and a Unitarian, and I plan to stay a Unitarian. I think that I'm atheist, and I will be that. I think loving and helping others and doing good because it is good, not because there's a God, not because something or someone is watching me to make me do good. So for me, the afterlife is if people, when I'm gone, remember me as a good person and as someone who has helped others.
Well, I don't know which of us is going first, but I'll always think of you as a good person. Any other comments from anyone? Yeah, if there are, we could discuss them afterwards. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dick. And now, if you would rise in body or spirit, hymn 341, you will notice, does not include the word God.